what drives you? I mean,
well, what drives me is I always wanted to understand how the world actually works, what's actually going on here. So the research I've been doing has been kind of very much in what's called fundamental physics, trying to understand kind of basic building blocks of reality, right? That's what string theory is about. The last couple of years, what I've been doing is this amazing interest currently in what's called quantum technologies, and in particular what's called topological quantum technologies. And turns out, even though everybody's talking about these in the field as if everything is already clear-cut and just a matter of going to the lab and engineering it, turns out there's actually lots of theoretical open problems in this field that haven't really been addressed.
Hello, everybody. This is the latest About Logic podcast, and we are very happy to have Urs Schreiber here. So Urs is working as a senior scientist for the University of New York in Abu Dhabi, and he is very well known for very high-level quantum stuff, if I may summarize this like this. So yeah. Maybe, Urs, can we start? Maybe can you give a better description of what you're doing?
Right. Thanks, first of all, for having me. That's a great honor. It's great to see you do this kind of podcast. So what I'm doing research-wise, in the last years, we've been entering the subject that has now come to be called quantum, which is a bit just quantum, which is a bit surprising for people who have been brought up studying quantum mechanics, but now there's a field just called quantum, concerned with quantum phenomena, quantum technologies. Originally, I've been working on aspects of high energy physics related to string M theory. So, with Hisham Sati, my long-term collaborator, we have this long program of mathematically understanding what is a brain in M theory, and by doing so, we eventually found some structures that are actually interesting.
So, brain is BRANE, right?
Yes. Right. Right. Yeah. Thanks for stopping.
No consciousness yet.
Like in membrane, it's a higher dimension.
Yeah. I know. Membrane. I just wanted to clarify this for the audience.
Right. So that's what I'm doing: topological quantum physics with relation to high energy physics and occasional application of higher topos theory, which is, I guess, the reason why I'm kind of connected to some aspects of logic.
Yeah, can you give it a more sort of mundane account? What this is really about? I mean, you come from string theory, but you're not sort of focused on string theory in the moment. But anyway, how would you describe it to a person who's interested? What drives you? I mean.
Right. Well, what drives me is I always wanted to understand how the world actually works, what's actually going on here. So the research I've been doing has been kind of very much in what's called fundamental physics, trying to understand kind of basic building blocks of reality, right? That's what string theory is about. And so more recently, it's kind of exciting for me that we're actually entering or making contact to experimental physics. We, in our last articles, we make actual predictions about phenomena that might be seen in experiment. But it's still driven by understanding fundamental physics. So there's a, if I just look at the last couple of years, what I've been doing is there is this this amazing interest currently in what's called quantum technologies, and in particular what's called topological quantum technologies. And turns out, even though everybody's talking about these in the field as if everything is already clear-cut and just a matter of going to the lab and engineering it, turns out there's actually lots of theoretical open problems in this field that haven't really been addressed. And so that's what we're looking at. We're trying to solve some open problems, theoretical open problems. Like, what is an onion, for instance? That's something that occupies me these days.
So onions are in between fermions and bosons. Is this right? So,
That's very, very good that you say this, because that's where the problem already starts. That's how it's already always introduced in all the textbooks. And I think that's already the wrong way to go about it. That's not actually quite correct. Of course, there's some truth to it. So otherwise,
for a moment, can we first tell people what are fermions and bosons and what's the difference?
Right. Right. So there, you know, in the standard model of particle physics, there's an assumption that the world is made of elementary particles that fall into these two classes. One class is called the bosons. That's all the particles that transmit forces. For instance, the photon that is the quantum of light is the archetype, typical example of a boson. And on the other hand, there's the stuff that these forces act on, the matter that the universe is made of, and that consists mostly of fermions, like, for instance, electrons and quarks. So, yeah. And so there was a big insight back in the last century, in the last millennium, that there's this dichotomy. These bosons and fermions, mathematically, they fall into different representations, as one says, linear representations of the symmetric group. So there's this this funny effect that was figured out many decades ago that the wave functions, so the kind of the probability amplitudes for several electrons changes its sign when two of these electrons exchange their places. Like in theory, if you were to exchange two electrons in the universe, turns out the corresponding wave function that describes the probability amplitude for the whole system to be in some state changes its sign. Which of course is something that is not actually observable because only the square of this wave function is observable. But there's a phase called the sign, and bosons don't have that sign. So when you exchange two bosons, the wave function doesn't change. When you exchange a pair of fermions, pick up this sign. And then some time ago, this started in the 70s. People wondered whether there might be other possibilities, whether there might be particles such that when you exchange them, the wave function picks up another factor, maybe a complex phase, which is not plus one, which is not minus one, but is maybe some root of unity, right? So some complex number that has modulus one, but has a different phase. And that was, for a long time, was just a theoretical curiosity. So these things have then been called anions. So this is a pun on any possible phase that might appear, any mm-hmm. on, right? So there's this general convention that every particle gets called something on, and so the any ons mm-hmm. are those that might have any phase. So people, theoretically looked at this in the past, just out of curiosity, really, checking what method.
How is this related to the notion of spin? I mean, I thought obviously bosons are even... even half and fermions are odd half spins. Does this make any sense, or is this related, or is this not really relevant?
No, it's absolutely related. It's though one of the more subtle aspects maybe of modern physics. This is called the spin statistics theorem, which says that in a consistent relativistic local quantum field theory, the fermions that are sort of if you first characterize just by that exchange phase, they also have to have a spin one half or odd spin, which is actually not so easy to see. But that, first of all, it's just observed in nature. Electrons have spin, bosons have a sort of spin one. That is the case for quite subtle reasons, actually. So kind of amazingly, with the rise of the new fashion of, or the new, how should one call it, with quantum technologies, so with technology progressing to the point that various quantum effects that had been discussed theoretically for a long time, that they suddenly became actually measurable and testable in experiment, that led to the remarkable situation, or has led to the situation we're in now, where anions have actually been observed in the laboratory. Just very recently, this started in 2020, Nakamura et al. Were the first to, there were claims before that, but they were the first to maybe definitely actually see that anion phase in the laboratory, and has been confirmed by a few groups since, which is kind of remarkable because there are other claims, there's some big companies on this planet who have been claiming to see something related, but it has never been reproduced by other people. But in so-called fractional quantum Hall systems, these anions are not actually seen. And but I wanted to answer your question whether they are in between bosons and fermions. The big difference is these anions are not elementary particles.
Compound particles. Huh?
Yeah, they're. Mm-hmm. One should think of them as being solitons, or so they're kind of excitations of the entire system in some sense. Mm-hmm. So they're rather different from bosons and fermions. And there's a bit of a mathematical coincidence about this exchange statistics. So I think it's actually technically wrong to speak of anion statistics. There's braiding phases that are being picked up, but it's not quite the same thing as the bosons and fermions. But anyways, I mean, that's a subtlety maybe that need not concern us here.
And these anions, can they be useful for building a quantum computer, or is this more a theoretical interest? What we have there?
Well, both certainly. I mean, they're certainly just theoretically interesting, but in particular now there's a big interest in them because this is the big idea of how to actually go about building large-scale useful quantum computers to equip them with what's called topological protection. And anions are the way to do that. So there's this big, right, this big hope currently. It's very small, tiny quantum computers have been built in the lab that run for a few microseconds, so-called NISQ machines, noisy machines, so quantum computers that in principle behave like one expects quantum computers to expect, but just on very tiny scales. So they're not actually useful for actual computations. And there is one big scheme that most of the community is pursuing, how to go about enlarging the existing quantum machines to useful size, and that is called quantum error correction. So the idea is the hardware sucks, but if we just make lots of it and insert lots of redundancy, then we can just keep fighting the errors that keep appearing in these systems so that we can push the boundary of how long these machines run without decohering and becoming useless. So this is kind of, you have a leaking bucket, right? And you want to transport your water to somewhere, your bucket is leaking. So what you do is you just say, okay, let's just run many, many leaking buckets. Then we can still maybe have some hope to bring our water. And the idea of topological quantum computing is to just fix the bucket, to try to have a non-leaking bucket. So a non-leaking qubit, topological qubit. And the idea for that is to use some certain fundamental quantum effects that are topological in the sense that they are insensitive to local small perturbations. So they only depend on some global phenomena, which means that if you have a little bit of noise shaking your system somewhere, it will not actually disturb the quantum state unless you actually completely break it. So that is the idea, that with topological quantum effects, you might be able to stabilize quantum computers at a fundamental hardware level. And anions is one or the big idea for how to go about this. The point being that this phase that the system picks up when two anions are exchanged is, you know, at least in theory, it only depends on the anions actually being exchanged, actually changing positions. It doesn't depend on how they do this. So they can wiggle around each other. They can do all kinds of funny stuff. As long as they have changed positions, the system will have picked up a phase. So that means it only depends on the topology, actually on the isotopy of the world lines of these anions. And if that could be used to actually construct quantum gates, which would then be called topologically protected, that is, in theory, at least one way of having, you know, robust quantum logic gates and hence quantum computers. It doesn't exist at the moment, but it's one idea for how to go about it.
Very good. That's very useful. Very interesting. Maybe let's move a bit on. So far, it's more about physics, which is also, I mean, logic and physics are related, I think. But okay, so you use quite high-level mathematics, I would say. I mean, I think you do like higher categories, and you're interested in homotropy type theory. Can you explain a bit what's the connection between your interest in physics and your sort of interest in these mathematical theories, which are quite advanced, let's say? I mean,
right. Yeah, so I was always motivated by understanding physics. So I started looking at what is known about, when I say physics, I mean mathematical physics, I guess. So I was looking at foundations. And then it's a well-kept secret. Everybody who has actually looked into these things knows this, that large swaths of, even of mathematical physics, actually using, I would say, inadequate mathematics for the kind of problems one wants to describe. Here's a very simple example which illustrates where this problem already starts and where the topos theory comes in. So, you know, it's folklore. Everybody knows that something is very difficult with quantum field theory, right? Everybody knows, oh, there's these infinities that they run into and they need to renormalize, and something is very difficult mathematically. So one might ask, well, where do these difficulties actually start? And there's a very simple original fact that is sort of known but not widely appreciated, which is this. Of course, the configuration space of a physical field, which permeates all of space-time, is a mapping space. So if, for instance, you have a scalar field like the Higgs field or something, one configuration of that field, or think of the magnetic field that currently inhabits all of this space that we're living in. So it's essentially, okay, with the magnetic field, I'm cutting some corners, but if we speak about the Higgs field, for instance, it's literally true that a configuration of this field is a map from space-time to some target space, like the complex numbers, which to each point in our space that we inhabit assigns a number or something more complicated than a number, but assigns something in some target space. So the whole configuration is a map from space-time points to whatever values that field takes, right? Be it complex numbers or some spin representation or a group or something like this. Okay. And the space of all these maps, mathematically the mapping space, the topological space with all these maps, that is the configuration space of the system, in the same way that if you look at just a single particle, its configuration space is just ordinary space, just R3, right? Mm-hmm. It's just the number of positions or the set of positions that the particle can inhabit. Now, for a field, it's not just R3, but it's maps from R3 into some other space. And what you want to do is you want to do differential geometry on this configuration space. You want to say, okay, there's a symplectic form on this space. We can produce some pre-quantum line bundle with the symplectic form being its curvature. So in order that you can quantize it, you want to analyze some Hamiltonian vector field. So you want to do differential geometry on this space. This is what physics tells you need to do after you've sorted out your configuration.
Can you quickly say something? What is differential geometry?
Oh, I see. I see. Right. So so differential geometry is the study of geometry that is sensitive to infinitesimal, very small, tiny variations. So as opposed to topology, where we care only about the broad global structure of a space, in differential geometry we actually care about how exactly it looks locally. What exactly is, for instance, if I move a particle just a tiny bit, what is the distance it has been moved? As opposed to just knowing, I have moved it across the universe, did it encircle some hole in the universe or not? This is what topology knows. In differential geometry, we know what happens locally. So most of physics is concerned with differential geometry. For instance, the momentum of a particle, its velocity vector is an object in differential geometry, if you wish, not visible in topology. And that's, of course, what controls physical systems. The velocity at a certain instance of time determines how the system evolves. So differential geometry, yeah. So that's why we need to do differential geometry.
Can we say it's sort of an abstract way in looking at sort of smooth geometry in a way? I mean, if you have a naive idea about a geometry and sort of, I don't know, surfaces and what you can do with it, and this differential geometry is a sort of more abstract way to look at geometry in this sense. Is this a fair description or...?
Right, of course, that's the technical term. We speak of a smooth space if it has been equipped with a notion of how to differentiate on it, how to do this local analysis for it. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Of course, if this helps the audience, then differential geometry is about smooth structure as opposed to just topological structure. That's right, yes. And now the funny thing is that... Now we're looking at a mapping space from one smooth space or space-time manifold or just spatial manifold into this target manifold. And it turns out only under very constraining conditions is there a smooth manifold structure, an ordinary smooth structure that you may find in the textbooks on this mapping space. So technically, if the domain space has to be a compact manifold, for instance, which is exactly what you don't want to assume in physics. You don't want to assume there's a compactness as a mathematical condition. It kind of means your space is bounded. It ends somewhere. And that's certainly not what we want to assume for a physical space.
Yes.
And so strikingly, on the very first step in doing field theory, not even quantum field theory, just classical field theory. You want to say, okay, what on which space are we doing differential geometry now? Turns out you're doing on this mapping space, which just doesn't have a textbook smooth structure. So you cannot actually, unless you restrict to artificial situations, you cannot actually open a textbook and do differential geometry on this space. It's kind of striking. And this is known to people who work on this, and yet... And this is part of the reason why, you know, these infinities and stuff crop up in physics, because what people do is they put some tricks instead of doing the actual differential geometry. They just kind of work with formal Taylor series, which with things that look like they could come from a differential geometry without actually being such. And so you wave your hands, and just from the first step on, you actually do something different than the Newton sort of would have told you had he known about field theory. And maybe to cut this story short, because I'm turning this out too long-windedly here. Topos theory.
So isn't it that often mathematicians, there is this conflict. The mathematicians say that physicists are cheating and do things which are actually not really mathematically justified. And is this basically such a case? I mean, where they do use structures which are really not applicable because of what you just said, because these spaces are not compact, and just pretend to do it, and somehow things work out. And you are now saying, actually, we can fix this. We can sort of make both mathematicians and physicists happy, sort of. I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
That's exactly the summary, yes. Exactly. There's all these steps in physics, famously, so where the math is lagging behind. Physicists just do stuff. They kind of know what they want, right? So they have this application in mind. And so if the math is not quite available, you do something that looks like it's going in the right direction, because you're not a pure mathematician. You have an application in mind. That happens not only in physics. It happens in other fields. But of course, in physics, it's most noticeable. Yeah, and then at some point, things go wrong. You know, this is where these words renormalization come from, right? So this is this famous step in quantum field theory. You start quantizing your field theory, and then at some point you say, oh, we need to renormalize. I mean, the word literally says you need to make things normal again, right? You just pretend everything should work, and you only stop when you run into an actual contradiction, when things actually don't work. And then you say, okay, let's step back and try to fix it. So you didn't use proper...
infinity.
Yeah, right. So you get something that is nonsense. So you say, oh, well, okay, all right. Yeah, we knew we cheated a bit, so let's backtrack and fix things. and then once you've renormalized...
By cheating more.
Well, eventually, like over long periods of history, some things actually are sorted out. So the renormalization was eventually understood, actually. Renormalization is now a mathematically well-defined thing. But then next you need to cancel anomalies. That's another thing that goes wrong, and then so things keep going wrong. You just keep going, exactly. And so the question is actually, if you right, I mean, it's kind of urgent in these days. So when I started studying physics, right, there was already at the time when everybody said, okay, we know everything about this standard model. Now we need to understand the deeper physics. So we need to go to the foundations. And then an evident question is, well, if already the physics that you claim to understand is actually not on solid ground, you don't really know what you're actually talking about. How can you go further to ask for more foundational physics if you already lost really with the non-foundational stuff? So that is the motivation for saying that let's check first what are these things really. And in some cases, it's not so hard. It's not like it's a big mystery. You just have to look at it and know some modern math, and then the answers are there, right? And this gets us to the topos theory that you asked about. So it turns out it's very easy actually to give a smooth structure to a mapping space. That is exactly what topos theory does. It produces for you a Cartesian closed category where mapping spaces, the internal Holms, are on exactly the same footing as all the other objects. So there is a larger... So physicists, like since the beginning of the last century, they work in this category of smooth manifolds, which is just not large enough. It doesn't contain these mapping spaces. But the category of smooth manifolds, and that's fully faithfully, inside the topos that are called the topos, we call the topos of smooth sets, the topos of sheaves on all smooth manifolds.
Can we, for a moment, explain what the relevance of a topos here is? Is like that You basically replace the theory you're working in, like talk about sets or types or whatever, and all the constructions you do, and you move them into a different sort of world. You put yourself into a world, into a different topos, which looks very much of what you're used to, but which is somehow different. Is this a good way to say it?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, topos have these two aspects. There's always the logical and the geometric aspect to it. But yeah, what drives the story from physics here is this geometric aspect. Yes. So from this original Grothendieck style aspect, a topos is kind of just a better universe in the mathematical sense, a better category, or in the logical sense, even a better category of spaces, of whatever notion of geometry you're interested in. For every notion of geometry, there is a topos that contains spaces of that geometric kind, and all their, as you know, all their limits and co-limits and mapping spaces. So it's a context in which constructions that you want to be doing on your objects do exist in a natural canonical way. Yeah, that's how it begins.
So what's happening is that these manifolds, which didn't exist or which didn't exist in the usual classical topos, if you go into a topos which is given by some particular construction, then inside this topos you all of a sudden, what was a cheat before, now becomes completely reasonable construction.
Yeah, exactly. So for instance, these mapping spaces, these spaces of field configurations, they just exist now. They are formed by what's technically called the internal HOM, formed in this topos, this internal HOM from your space-time manifold, which is now an object of that topos, to, say, the complex numbers, which is also now an object of that topos. One can form this mapping space or internal HOM and continue operating on it. Or one can ask for differential forms on it. So do all the things that a differential geometer wants to do. Things just exist, yes.
So that's the kind of, I mean, it's a kind of synthetic mathematics, right? That you work inside this topos, and certain principles hold there, which are not valid sort of analytically in your meta theory, so to say. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I would say that's, I mean, for people entering this field, that's kind of the next step. So first of all, you can just embed your manifolds into the topos without talking highbrow synthetic mathematics. It's just a new definition that is more flexible. But then, of course, once you are in this more general context, you want to ask, okay, so what does such and such standard construction, which you're used to from the textbooks, where it's explained in terms of sigma algebras or, you know, some local construction, what does it mean now to do this same construction on a general object in this topos, right? So you need to lift the standard definitions now to the new objects. You need to say, okay, I just mentioned it. What is a differential form on a mapping space? You can't find it in the textbooks. You only find what is a differential form on an ordinary manifold. So now you need to lift that definition to this more general context. And so one can just do this by trial and error. But of course, the more satisfactory and more sustainable way is that you ask, well, what is the characteristic property actually of that construction? What do I want that construction to be like? What properties should it actually satisfy? So that I can just go and define something new now for my new spaces, but I want to be assured that this is the right generalization. So I first go and say, any given analytic definition that I had before, let's actually analyze, why did we make this definition in such a way that we did? What are its abstract properties? And then just try to say whatever has the same abstract properties now in more generality is the correct generalization. And that is the synthetic approach, where you say, instead of building something concretely and analytically, you say, well, let's check if it quacks like a duck, if it walks like a duck, and all these things, then it's probably a duck, right? That's the approach of the synthetic. Yeah, exactly. And so this is how the physicist, whose interest, as I was at this time, right, I had no background in logic, in foundations of math, nothing. I was just interested in physics. But this is how one gets drawn into the story now. And then next you ask, well, okay, how can I now formalize the kind of physics that I actually want to be doing? what is a jet bundle in the topos, so that I can say what is a differential equation, what is an Euler Lagrange solution. So all these things that people usually do, you want to do it in the topos. And that, yeah, leads you down this rabbit hole. And then before long, you find yourself looking at modal operators and stuff. And then people will tell you that this has something to do with logic. Yeah, that's how it happened.
So you come to logic from physics and trying to understand the basic building blocks of the world, right? In a systematic way. Yeah.
Maybe a very naive question. Is this all guided by theoretical consideration? So the math should look nice, or is there there hope to decide these things experimentally in which topos we live, so to speak? I mean, because we can, in theory, decide at which manifold we live, right? If we have this older picture of physics. Is there a chance for that, or is this purely for the math?
No, I would say it's certainly not for the math. I mean, not just for the math, right? It's certainly about trying to understand the physics. Now, of course, within the physics, you can still make the distinction. Are we just going after formal physics, so just theoretical physics, or are we even trying to connect to what the experimenters can actually measure in the laboratory?
Yeah.
Of course, a huge fraction of the community, the physics community, it has actually decoupled from experiment. It's just asking abstract questions. There are kind of in between math and experiment, really, that are formal physics or theoretical physics. But of course, these things hang together. Even this formal physics, even though it has been going on now for decades without contact to experiment, of course, the hope, the idea is still that someday in the future we will be able to also connect that back to experiment. That's, of course, always the ultimate goal. But then there's also concrete questions. No, nothing of this is motivated just by the math. But of course, I would say if you're an end user of math, you want to actually use stuff, then there's some motivation in keeping the math elegant and nice. Because if your math becomes very complicated, then you're not going to able, because as a physicist, you know that your career will not end with studying this definition. No, this is just the zero step. You know, you want to use this definition. So if the definition already goes all over the place and becomes, you know, just needs a whole career to just study it in itself, then it's not going to be useful for you. And so that is, or was for me at least, a big motivation for actually going for elegant math, because it's just the zero step in this.
I'm thinking, isn't there a sort of like a historical, I mean, are there lots of historical examples for this? I mean, I think about Faraday, who had a sort of intuitive understanding of electromagnetism, but then there was Maxwell and others who developed the math to give a really concise description of this, yeah. And I think this is happening, continues to happen. I mean, with Einstein and general relativity, he had a naive understanding, it was being more naive, but he had an understanding what's going on. But then to really make it precise, he had to develop some new mathematics, yeah. And going on to quantum mechanics, you can see, I mean, Bohr, Copenhagen. Yeah, there is a sort of naive, I mean, okay, it goes a bit further. There's a naive understanding, even quantum field theory, that we have quite fields which are a wave function of fields or whatever. So there is a naive understanding what's going on. But then we need to develop new math to actually make this precise. And as all this is saying, there's unavoidable need to develop the language to talk about the world, reflecting our sort of maybe intuitive understanding of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a back and forth that has been going on for eons, for ages. It starts with Newton, really. Newton has this intuition, I think that's fair to say, about his laws, and then develops calculus in order to put it on mathematical grounds. I mean, it starts right there.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, it keeps going. Von Neumann invents the foundation of quantum mechanics. People invent differential geometry for matrix mechanics. Like, this has been going on for a long time, of course, but this process of back and forth between math and physics got somehow stuck sometime in the 60s of the last century, with the invention of quantum field theory, there was a kind of disconnect suddenly, where physics just kept going, and mathematics was, or the mathematical formulation was actually falling, and has been falling behind. And I don't know exactly why. That's maybe an interesting discussion one could have, but it just happened. And I don't think it necessarily happened. You know, some people think like, oh, the math just doesn't exist, but that's not the case. It doesn't. You can go and look for it. You have to, of course, I mean, we have to understand both. And that, of course, gets harder the further time progresses, right? Back in the days, it was easier for a scholar to be expert actually in both mathematics and physics. These days, it's very hard. Even most physicists don't only understand a tiny fraction of the field of physics. And of course, most mathematicians just understand a tiny sector of mathematics. So it becomes harder and harder to kind of scan both worlds to see which puzzle pieces actually do need to be fit together. So that probably explains in parts why things have slowed down. But on the other hand, at this point, we really need to mention William Levere, the widely known as maybe the father of at least elementary topos theory, right? And of abstract category theory. He was all motivated. If you read his interviews, he keeps saying it again and again. He was all motivated by understanding physics. He was actually the one early on who said that we need toposes in order to describe what he calls continuum mechanics. So as far as I understand or recall the story from his interviews is that as a student, he actually started in a physics department. He was handed the task of solving some problem in fluid dynamics, continuum dynamics. And so and that involves vector fields. So kind of assignments of directions on a manifold in a smooth way. And he at that point, he said, well, what is a vector field? Which, of course, was a silly question for everybody else around him, because that was meant to be long known since the days of Einstein, you know, the 1920s. But he asked it again and says, what is it actually? And I'm not sure how well this is known, that Levere's development of topos theory as elementary topos theory, so as a context for a universe of mathematics, was motivated, he keeps saying this, was motivated by this desire to find this foundation for physics, for at least continuum mechanics. So that's why he develops what's called synthetic differential geometry, because he thinks, so this is a way of synthetically doing differential geometry and toposes, because he thinks or thought, that is the way to go, and that is the way to go. Yeah, so that turned out to be right. Even though I don't think he ever saw it. I don't think he recognized that people had started applying it to kind of real world physics problems. But yeah, he was certainly the one who envisioned this first.
Maybe can I try to change the angle a little bit as somebody interested in foundations of mathematics? I would say this back and forth is clear. I strongly believe in that. But I would see it as like there are like very different mathematical theories. And the moment you get interest from physicists, this theory will get a boost and it will get dominant. And every student needs to learn about vector spaces because the physical application, so to speak. So I was wondering if you have any thoughts about category theory, topos theory, and their links to physics, and what this might have to do with the foundations of math. So would you say set theory?
Type theory.
And time, right. So would you think that a reason one might argue why category theory might become a foundation is that it gets more interest in contrast to set theory, or is that nothing you would think about?
Oh, I see. You're asking maybe on the one hand, category theory has slowly becoming more prominent among some physicists, right? As opposed to set theory. Yeah. And you're asking, is this just a fashion? Is it just that the physicists ended up liking category theory more for some superficial reasons? Or is it for some more profound systematic reason? Is that the question?
Yeah, this and what this might have as long-term results for the mathematical community, if you want to conjecture something in that direction.
Right. I mean, I can say something to this, but maybe you can tell me what your thoughts are. Maybe you have, because I'm certainly not a set theorist, and I don't really know what's going on in set theory as a research community. But But what I can say is that the reason whenever category theory has actual success in physics. I mean, these days, there's, if I may say this, let's put this in polite words, there's, you know, what's called applied category theory now. There's this attempt to kind of push category theory on applications. But I think, the real role of let's at least say the natural, the original role of category theory is theory building, right? That's how it came into being. It was meant to be an underlying framework in order to come to grips with concepts in algebraic topology. That's why Eilenberg and MacLane introduced it. And that's what it's best at. It's for theory building, right? Whenever you have a question that is not solve this equation in a well-defined context, or solve this problem which has already been completely defined and you just need to work it out. But when the question is a meta question, like what is the actual theory we're looking for? For instance, in math, a good example is, what is the field with one element? I don't know if you know this story, right? This was a big question that occupied people some time ago. It was not a theorem you could prove, but it was a conceptual question. People were after a good definition. Or in physics, you want to know you want to formulate a non-perturbative field. You want to find a new theory of physics. You want to find what is M theory. So you cannot solve an equation somewhere. And it's a different kind of problem. And that kind of problem, theory building, that is what category theory is good for. It gives you a structure of what theories are like. So you want to say, okay, which limits do I need, and stuff like this. And I think that is certainly one reason why category theory, where it is successful, has been successful in physics. And maybe
I feel that you answered this in a way when you said, this example of differential geometry, that you say, I have to look at the basic idea of the construction, which I thought translates always in what we call a universal property.
Yes.
And instead of like, so the differences in set theory, we do like concrete constructions of the assembly language of mathematics. But to build these theories, we really need to have more high-level ways to talk about things, and these are universal properties, and this is given by category theory and type theory and entropy theory and so on. I would say structural mathematics, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I guess that's what I meant by saying it's about theory building. You want to have something with some properties, and then right, all these structural theories tell you how to go about finding that thing. Whereas set theory certainly doesn't answer these kinds of questions, right? But maybe you could say what set theory is from your perspective. What is it that drives set theory like these days? Maybe can you say that? I would be interested in hearing.
Yeah, I mean, I would claim, and this might be empirically wrong, that these foundational questions aren't in the focus at all anymore. So no working mathematician really cares about that because we aren't in a crisis. Right, we have math is sufficiently rigorous, so set theory is a branch like every other branch, interested in either higher infinities or definability, and has very concrete questions and relations to other fields.
I mean, yeah, it's a question of consistency. Is maybe a bit of misguided focus for what is also important and is ignored is expressibility. I mean, this is the same as programming languages. Yeah, all programming languages you have are Turing complete, so there's no difference. You can compute, you can write all your programs as Turing machines, but Turing machines are not a very good way to program, right? And the question for me is, what are good way to structure your constructions? Yeah? And this is complete, as far as I can see, is ignored in set theory. They just build things in assembly language.
But I mean, you can abstract there as well, right? You can add syntactic sugar.
Yeah, but that's not what it's about. That's not what it's about. Yeah.
Or
at least that's my impression.
The study of infinities and.
We need to talk to more set theoreticians, I guess. So
we will invite some of them as well. But, yeah.
But can I move also a little bit on, because one thing I wanted to hear from Urs is How does this lead us to homotropy type theory and these things? Because I know that you are interested in this stuff as well, and maybe you can say something about this.
Right. So we've talked about how one way that one can see that toposes, ordinary toposes, show up in physics by providing you a context for discussing more general spaces, differential geometric spaces, or there's more. There's also supergeometric spaces and so forth. Anyway, so it's a way to give a home to the kind of spaces that appear in discussion of physical systems. But then it keeps going. So that is only... we talk about mapping spaces. Next, you might want to say, okay, we want infinitesimals in our space. That leads you to these toposes that model synthetic differential geometry. But then you keep going and say, well, next, a very big aspect of physics, modern physics, is the presence of gauge fields. So we mentioned these bosons, like the photon that is the quantum of light. And a big insight that goes back to Maxwell, which we started with, I think, is that, of course, it just goes back to him. It was illuminated later that this field of that the electromagnetic field, of which light is the wave, that this is an instance of what is called a gauge field. And gauge fields are very interesting in that they exhibit this kind of issue with the notion of equality that drives the research into homotopy type theory. So the big insight from the, what is it, 40s, 50s of the last century, is that the actual configuration of the electromagnetic field is not this Faraday tensor that Faraday and Maxwell thought was the description, but it's something different called the gauge potential, something of which the Faraday tensor is derived. And this gauge potential, whatever it is, it's a differential one form locally, is not defined up to equality. So it turns out that if you, even though the mathematical description involves this object, if you physically ask for the actual nature of the electromagnetic field, you have to regard some of these gauge potentials as being isomorphic. The physicist says gauge equivalent, even though they're not equal. So it's a very big deal in physics that gauge fields have this notion of gauge equivalence between them, which replaces the notion of equality. And if you formulate this in mathematical form, it means that, for instance, the configuration space of the electromagnetic field on some space is not actually a set. It's not also not a smooth set. So it's not even an object of your topos of sheaves and smooth manifolds, blah, blah, blah. It's actually a groupoid. So it's a set with gauge transformations between its elements, a set with notions of identifications between its elements. And that's kind of striking because that just arrives from in nature. You just observe it. And I think physicists have been actually discussing this much longer, even though more informally and improperly maybe, but even so, they have been discussing this much longer than the mathematicians, actually, like decades before mathematicians starting becoming very serious about this notion. And so... that leads you further. You know, we're still this physicist trying to understand what is actually the fundamental description of the universe. And so we realize, no, we just discovered toposes as being a good context for describing physical space, but it's still not sufficient. These toposes need to be promoted to something whose objects look like groupoids. And that, of course, is the notion of higher topos, of which homotopy type theory provides the corresponding syntax. So this is how this homotopy aspect enters the story. It's the notion of gauge fields, kind of remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good.
And then if I may just add a sentence to this, and then it doesn't end there. At least in this more explorative theoretical part of physics that is not always entirely connected to experiment, one sees that in physics, you want to go further. Next, there's what's called higher gauge fields that have higher gauge potentials, where even the gauge transformations between different field configurations don't have a notion of equality. But we have to keep going and say there may be two different gauge transformations relating a pair of physical field configurations, which themselves are related by what physicists call a gauge of gauge transformation. And it keeps going this way. There's ever higher gauge fields, and that exactly matches under the relevant translations the notion of higher homotopy entire multiple mm-hmm. types in mathematics, which is really remarkable, actually.
Okay. So just because we promised this in an earlier episode, we had Graham Priest here as a guest who looked into Hegel as a source for his contradictory logics, so the dialectic method and things like that. And back then we said that we will have another guest who also said something on Hegel. So since we are already over time, but we promised it, would you be willing to say a few words on this aspect? And we came from physics to computer science, mathematics, and also philosophy. So you touched quite a lot of disciplines.
Right. Yeah, maybe I can tell you the story of how I arrived at this Hegel business. Because just to continue what we've already said. So one is looking, one realizes now that physics needs to take place in some higher topos, what now called an infinity comma one topos. So the next question is, as we already mentioned, now you want to formalize these universal properties. You want to say, well, maybe it's not a random infinity comma one topos. It should be one because there's very many such things. You want one that inside which physics can take place. As we said, something like differential forms should exist in there. The standard infinity comma one topos. So you ask now, okay, what extra structure is it? And then, as we said, you want to formulate this in an elegant, universal, synthetic way, not by declaring lots of tiny little tidbits, but by saying very broadly what you need. And it, you know, I looked at this stuff and then I realized we need what is now called certain idempotent monads and comonads acting on this topos, being in adjunction to each other. And the funny story actually goes like so. I had no knowledge when I did this of modalities. I didn't know anything of Hegel and all these things. So I was giving a talk in Oxford actually on, you can still find this on YouTube, higher gauge theory in a cohesive infinity topos, where I was presenting these axioms. I said, okay, we need a higher topos and we need a sequence of adjoint monads on it, such and such. And then I said, look, if we have this abstractly, if this is my synthetic context, then I can construct gauge fields and do their quantization and sort. And that same evening, by coincidence, so this was some conference on, I don't know which topic, some higher geometry conference in Oxford. That same evening, there was the math colloquium in Oxford, independent, where Peter Johnston was speaking. Unrelated, he didn't attend the conference, but I saw on some schedule, I said, oh, look, here's a math colloquium just this afternoon by Peter Johnston. I just went there because Peter Johnston, of course, is a famous topos theorist. I was just, you know, generally interested. So I sat there, and this was a really striking experience because it goes to the board and he says, oh, I want to tell you about an idea of my colleague, William Levere, at that time, who just came out with his article on axiomatic cohesion. And he says, oh, look, Levere is studying toposes on which there exists a sequence of adjoint operators. I was like, this is really crazy because this was exactly the structure that I had just been writing to the board a few hours earlier that same day. So it was after this that I went home and said, okay, I need to clearly read what Levere has said about this. Clearly there's some kind of synthesis going on here. And then I realized that what Levere calls axiomatic cohesion on a one topos was exactly the kind of structure that I was had found or had kind of proclaimed on these infinity toposes. So then in the wake of this, I started digging into this. So I started talking about Levere on the N forum, so on the NLAP discussion side, and trying to, you know, put these pieces together and, you know, bring myself up to speed with what Levere had already done in this respect. And then David Corfield, you know, one of the regulars of the N forum, who's a philosopher of mathematics, so he has a philosophy background, he knew what I had never heard of. He knew that Levere had this interest in Hegel. And he kept telling me, he kept bringing up the name Hegel. And the first dozen of times or so, I just completely ignored him. I thought, come on. I mean, I want to focus you on some math. Let's not get distracted too much. But he kept saying, and at some point I said, all right, okay, let me look into it to see what's actually going on. So then I started reading what Levere actually said about Hegel. And then it clicked. I thought, well, yeah, that's just right. And then I started reading Hegel, and I went through a bit of a frenzy then for a couple of months, I think, because it seemed so bizarre that things would match so nicely. So Levere, for those who haven't seen this, Levere at some point in life had realized, or at least declared, but realized for himself that the funny kind of logic of opposites and duals that is going on in Hegel's science of logic Navier claims that this is actually well formalized by the notion of adjoints in category theory, and specifically by iterated adjoints, by adjoint triples, by sequences not just of a pair of adjoint functors, but of triples of them. And if you have a triple of adjoint functors, that gives you a pair of adjoint modalities by forming the corresponding monads and comonads. So that's really, Navier never quite said it that way, but that's really what's going on. His triples of adjoints really give you adjoint modalities. That's really the point. And a modality is a mathematical incarnation of a quality, right? It gives math a notion of quality. You cannot just say how much and true or false, but you can say how is something. Is it necessarily true? Is it possibly true? Is it discretely true? So it gives a qualitative way of letting math speak about qualities. And that's, of course, exactly what Hegel does. He keeps talking about the qualitative negation. And so he develops a kind of logic of quality. It's not of true and false. And this is, I think, why so many people who try to apply ordinary logic to Hegel get kind of frustrated or get lost. Lavier observed, he calls it the objective logic in his writings, that what Hegel was envisioning in a kind of intuitive way is a kind of modal logic of modalities in some topos. And that's how I got interested into Hegel. It's just really just in the wake of what Lavier saw. And then I looked a bit deeper. Maybe I knew a bit more physics than Lavier knew. And I got very excited about seeing that you can actually push this further than Lavier actually had. This sequence of modalities actually keeps going. And you can follow quite a few stages through Hegel's writings. And I thought that was really interesting. If I may add one sentence, what I found fascinating in reading Hegel's book was that Hegel says he wants to make philosophy a science again. So even though the science of logic, as the book is called, strikes many people these days as being completely out there and completely different from what we understand as modern science, the preface says no, he wants to turn philosophy into a science. And what he meant was he wanted to make it kind of a science of ontology. He wanted to have actual facts about the original notions. What does it mean to be, not to be, to have a quality? What does it mean for things to be in contradiction? He wanted to know this kind of in a precise sense, even though he was completely lacking from a modern perspective the formal tools for this. He was just doing it intuitively, which makes it so hard to read. It's more like a poem. Mm-hmm. But through the lens of what Lavier observed, you can actually play this game. And there is an ontology there where you say, well, let's take a topos, and it has an initial, every topos has an initial opposition in the sense of Hegel-Lavier. There's always the monad on the topos that sends everything to the terminal object, and the monad that sends everything to the initial object, the empty object, and they are adjoints to each other. And this is an initial opposition, if you regard these monads as being qualities, that they just exist just in every topos. And then you can ask, well, Hegel had this famous notion of resolution, Aufhebung in German, resolution of opposites. And Lavier gave a recipe of what this would mean formally. There's a notion of, if you have a joint pair of modalities, what it means for them to be resolved by another modality, namely them, both of the modal types become modal for this, even though they're opposite, being dual to each other, they're both modal for this next guy. And the next guy may have another adjoint. So you kind of resolve the opposition and then find a new opposition, and you can resolve again and find a new opposition. This actually turns out to be a well-defined mathematical process. And it turns out that a whole sequence, like 12 modalities that are actually needs in physics, starting with this differential geometry going to supergeometry in the end, so reaching the fermions that we started the discussion with, actually fits into the scheme of opposition and Aufhebung, opposition and Aufhebung.
Okay, so Thorsten, if you don't have a very urgent question, then let us thank you for being here, for giving us insights into these many different areas of interest you have.
Yes, thank you very much. That was really interesting.
Really. And for the audience, we will link to this talk you mentioned in Oxford. We will link to the NLAB that you shortly mentioned, which is a huge resource. And if you have any other reading recommendations, we will also link to them below. And to the audience, we can also say subscribe. There's a hype function I learned about recently. Like the video, comment, and we will see us in 2 weeks with the next About Logic podcast. So once again, thank you, Oz.